What I thought I would try and do in the short time available this morning, rather than talk in great detail about actual numerical results, I would try and put across to you some ideas, which are not entirely our original ideas, that have been stimulated by a wide research project. And this is a bit awkward because I can't see the pictures on my little screen here. I basically want to talk about the community ecological underpinnings of choices about, in this case, the National Reserve System, but the general principles would apply to the design of any reserve system from local through to national. There are many proposed consequences for biodiversity of climate change. I am going to focus just on this one, the idea that individual species responses will be variable and that they will generate communities of kinds that we have never before experienced. There are many potential management responses to the way biodiversity will be impacted upon by climate change. I am going to talk solely about those issues that relate to the National Reserve System. There is a much longer lecture that covers all of these other points. So what do we know scientifically? We know that sets of interacting species change across adjacent climates. One result of this, and this is the detailed results that underpin the principles I'm talking about today, is the Ibiska Queensland project. What we set out to do in this project, which is more or less finished in its primary form now, is examine the biodiversity, principally of invertebrates and plants, of rainforest ecosystems within a continuous forest gradient spanning 1,000 metres elevation. We carried out a thorough baseline survey, and we did it on the set of adjacent climates that are experienced by taking altitudinal slices through a continuous forest spread over a piece of landscape. And that was the basis for this project, the Ibiska Queensland project. It was a smart state project. It had a long scad of fairly stingy financial supporters who I won't list. The only non-stingy ones were Griffith University and the Queensland State Government. Good on them. It was a collaboration. We had 40 scientists from 17 countries visit the 20 permanent sites we established over a 1.5 year period. The idea was to develop biodiversity-based tools for detecting climate change impacts in the future by looking at the way in which subsets of biodiversity changed as we moved up this continuously forested mountainside. As I say, it was over a 1,000-metre gradient. It would have been nice if it could have been 3,000 or 4,000 metres, but Australia doesn't stretch to that, I'm afraid. So this was based at Lamington National Park, and we focused on subtropical rainforests and the associated warm temperate and cool temperate forests. Seems to me that altitudinal gradients, and I'm well aware of the many design issues with working on altitudinal gradients, nevertheless are one of the few ways in which we can study the impacts of climate change here and now, rather than waiting for 400 years, for example. Adjacent altitudes represent adjacent climates, and we have climate data which verifies that generalization. So this is our gradient stretching from the fully subtropical rainforest at about 300 metres elevation to cool temperate Nothofagus dominated rainforest at 1,100 metres elevation, with continuous rainforest in between. To date, we have results available on the vegetation, on the moth assemblages, on dung and ground beetles, on fruit flies, ants, some of the spiders, some of the springtails, and new results are coming to hand on a regular basis. The longer version of this talk goes through those painfully and exposes the diagrams to you one by one. Essentially, though, all of the results look the same. There are low altitude specialists at the species level. There are high altitude specialists. There are mid elevation specialists, and there are low to mid altitude tolerant species. There are mid to high elevation tolerant species, rather fewer of them. And there are generalists. This is not surprising to any collector of insects or biodiversity information. But it is interesting that almost, I had anticipated that some taxa would show much clearer results than others. In fact, at the assemblage level, all taxa essentially show those patterns. So what are the consequences of this sort of appreciation for first ecosystem classification? Classically, based on vegetation analysis, we would divide this range probably into three different vegetation zones, ecosystems if you like, with ecotones, transitional sections in between. We would talk about subtropical rainforest. People do talk about subtropical rainforest. This picture is filched from the web and it's not from Lamington, but it's not dissimilar. Similarly, warm temperate rainforests in between, and cool temperate rainforests up at the top. This is from the Otway, so it's a different species of Melphophagus, but the general appearance is the same. So we have, and you can subdivide that in all sorts of different ways if you choose. What has this got to do with the National Reserve System? Well, in principle, the National Reserve System is based on the idea of reserving, preserving or restoring ecosystems. And there's been the much vaunted CAR system out there, in which a National Reserve System should build based on ideas of comprehensiveness, that is to say, you should have or as many as possible of the nationally visible identified ecosystems in that system. You should have an adequate variety of each, and you should have truly representative examples of each. And this is based more or less on analysis of what we imagine the vegetation looked like in 1788. This is based on the, well, most at national level, on the IBRA system and its derivatives, a classification of groups of ecosystems that looks like this, which divides the nation into a number of bioregions, each one of which captures a selection of local ecosystem types. It then becomes the goal of national and state reserve systems to make a representative and adequate collection of ecosystems in its national estate, as far as it can. Identify, we all know of specific examples, ecosystem types that are rare in the collections, that are the penny blacks of the reserve collection, the Brigalow, for example, or some of these grassy woodlands in Tasmania. There are other instances where we have plenty in our collection. Well, that's just the underlying vegetation map. So, clearly, there are very distinctive desert types. There are, this is Cape Tribulation, fantastic, coastal, fully tropical, lowland rainforests. There are high elevation, heathy woodlands, as here in Tasmania, or there's one of the penny blacks, the Brigalow system in central western Queensland. So how will the species that make up these ecosystems respond under climate change? Let's go back to these these generalized Ibisca results. Some species will simply go extinct. Many of the specific species associated with the high elevations will simply wink out. I can think of no management intervention that will preserve natural populations of all of them. Others will have reduced ranges. They won't actually go extinct, but their altitudinal ranges, or by implication the set of ecosystems in which they occur, will become smaller. Some will move upwards. There we go. Some will remain unchanged. And some species will move in. Things that the purists would now consider to be exotics will become a natural, whatever that is, or a naturally occurring part of those ecosystems. So what would happen if we then went back and reclassified those ecosystems? We would identify new sets that of which we have no present experience. And this has a lot of implications for policy. Now going at a great rate, Steve. So in order to adapt our national or local policy on reserve selection, first of all, we've got to have baseline information. Unless you know what's changing, what the baseline is, what you're monitoring, what's changing, I don't see how you can make adaptive decisions. We have to change our reserve philosophy from one of philately to insurance, and that means thinking about ecosystems and their value to us in functional rather than phenomenological terms. The presence or absence of tigers in a forest elsewhere never influenced the existence or usefulness of that forest, sadly, much as I love tigers. And this means upgrading the adaptive in adaptive management. We pay a great deal of lip service to adaptive management. Adaptive management sort of assumes there's a pure platonic ideal of management out there in which we will retain, restore and maintain things the way they were in that very arbitrary date, 1788. Under climate change, the goalposts will move continually. Therefore, adaptation, both scientifically and in terms of policy, will also need to be continually on the move.